Blog Talk Radio.
Good Saturday morning, everybody, and welcome to another great episode we have for Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb. We got a great show for you today. Today we're going to have author Simon Tolkien coming up to talk about his latest book, The King of Diamonds. And we're going to have a special guest that's going to be coming on after Simon later, so you want to make sure you stick around and check that out. But the great thing is 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. Thank you, everybody, for joining us here on a great Saturday morning. We have on Suspense Radio. Great show for you today. We're so pleased that we're going to be able to have Simon Tolkien coming on up here just in about 2 minutes. First thing I want to go ahead is I want to let you know I saw an article yesterday that was another author that went ahead and decided to was a fabulous ebook sensation, got picked up by St. Martin's. It was actually like a $2 million contract. You can check that out. And her name was Amanda something. I hadn't heard of her, but she was downloading a ton of ebooks all over the place. And on the flip side of that, we just got word that another author decided to go from a publisher and said, I'm going to self-publish. There's a great article about that. But author Barry Eisler decided that he's not going to take the $500,000 contract that was offered to him. He's going to go ahead and he's going to do it all on his own. So he decided to opt out of that. And we're going to have him talk on the radio show in a couple weeks here. We're going to be at the RT Book Convention in Los Angeles. And he's going to be able to come on and tell us exactly why he decided to do that. Like I said, there's a great blog with him and J.A. Conrath on the breakdown of the whole business of what they have experienced and why they did what they did. And that's something that maybe you should go and check out. And, you know, just type in Barry Eisler, J.E. Conrath, search for it, and you'll see a great blog. It's quite lengthy, but that's because they break everything down. And if you know Barry and J.A., both of them do love to talk. And they will definitely give you, without a doubt, the skinny on anything, which is always fascinating, especially with the ever-changing world of publishing. And David Morrell here is going to send us a couple articles that he wrote about the change of publishing that we're going to put in our May edition of our magazine because he's one of the pioneers almost coming up with going from the regular book side, I guess the print book side, over here to the ebook side. But our first guest today is Simon Tolkien, and he is the author of the book that is out here, The King of Diamonds, and this is his third book, the first one, Final Witness, and then The Inheritance. And the first thing I want to let you know is, yes, don't let the name fool you, because he is the grandson of J.R.R. Tolkien. But Simon is not science fiction. This is this is murder mystery stuff for The King of Diamonds. Excellently done. Suggest everybody to check this book out. And we are so pleased to have Simon with us this morning. Simon, how are you doing? Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I'm really pleased. Thanks. All good.
So here we go. Third book out of the gate, King of Diamonds. And like you said, this is first and foremost a murder mystery, but you did actually went back to your first love as a kid from a game that you called Buccaneer, where it was a bunch of jewels and things around, and that was kind of like your inspiration behind the book of the King of Diamonds. Can you elaborate a little more on the book and how things are going?
Yeah, I think it started with diamonds, John. When you're a kid, what you remember, your kind of first memories are really vivid on your mind. They're kind of really engraved. And I remember this game. I've actually tried to get it on the internet, but it's not available anymore, in which you had little boats and you moved them like with dice across the squares on the board from one to another. And there was sort of a piratic theme and all that. And I kind of was always interested in diamonds and jewels of all kinds. And I guess that linked in with my interest in history, because with diamonds especially, there are specific diamonds, that have had a huge effect on people's lives through history.
Oh, yeah.
And people have obviously done the most awful things. You know, there's the Hope Diamond, the Regency Diamond, the Koh-i-Noor, and you can actually you can chart their travels from one hand to another. And I guess in a common sense way, because they attracted such interest because they were worth so much that people were prepared to do the most horrible things in order to gain possession of them. But each of them began to have legends and curses attached to them, rather like Tutankhamun's tomb. So mm-hmm. that always fascinated me, and I wanted to write a book which was centered on diamonds. And in fact, there is a specific diamond that I've taken in The King of Diamonds, the Regency Diamond, which was found in India in the 18th century, and used that, or rather a cutting from it, as the actual engagement ring that the villain gives to the lady in the middle of the book.
Well, anybody who's married just know that there's a curse over top of diamonds with your wife, because once she gets one, well, I tell you what, they seem to go crazy, so that is definitely all true. But now, the reason why you went ahead and you decided to pick the Regency Diamond, was there a story behind it that people might not know about? Because, of course, the Hope Diamond is very famous, for its curse, and like you said, King Tut. Is there a backstory behind this Regency Diamond that people might not know about?
Yeah, the very beginning is kind of shrouded in mystery. There's a number of accounts, but generally the idea is that a slave who was working on the mine, because the first diamonds came out of India in the 18th century, of 17th, 18th centuries. And this was one of the biggest diamonds. You can go down into a mine and you can find something small or you can find something enormous. And once in a blue moon, you find something enormous. And this was a huge diamond, the biggest that had actually ever been found up to that time. And the slave who was working in the mine, it was called the Partial Mine on the Krishna River, realized what he'd found. So what he did is he cut his leg and he wound bandages around the cut. And he actually concealed the diamond within the bandages.
In the wound.
Yeah, in the wound. Kind of horrific. And then he managed to get to the coast undetected, where he did a deal with a sea captain to take him to the port of Madras, which is on the east coast of India.
Right.
But the sea captain, and the idea was that they would sell the diamond when they got to Madras. But the sea captain pitched him overboard, having taken the diamond for himself. And so that's where it began. So, the idea is it begins with death, and then it was taken by a man called Thomas Pitt, who had a series of misfortunes. He was the governor in India. And it was then sold by the Pitt family to the Regent of France, the Duc d'Orléans, for Louis XV. And he was then owned by the French royal family. It was worn by Marie Antoinette in a black cap on her head. And, there's a series of curses that are associated. Both Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette were guillotined during the French Revolution. And then it carried on in the French royal family. And then maybe it saved Napoleon III because his wife, the Empress Eugenie, was also wearing it on a trip to the opera in 1850. And there was a bomb thrown at the carriage, and the coachman and the horses all died, but the emperor and his wife survived. So it's kind of a mixed history. But the idea being is that when you get a diamond like that, in order to actually turn it into something amazing, you have to cut it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when you cut it, it's when the actual fire is released from it. Back in the 17th century, they didn't really know that, and it was in the 17th century they began to understand that if you can cut it in a way, then the actual light that comes out of the diamond is reflected and refracted, which is what releases the fire inside it. And when that happened to the Regency diamond, there were cuttings from it that were then, you know, turned into other diamonds. And I made that in my fiction, the diamond that is used by the villain.
Now, you decided to bring back your inspector, Inspector Trave, the character who is in your book, The Inheritance. Now, were you wrapping yourself around Inspector Trave to say he's about the only character that you can see involved in this story here, the King of Diamonds?
How do you mean? Explain to me.
Well, because there's a lot of people that I try to say is, you know, the character and the story and the plot are two different things. And the idea here that you decide to take your character and bring him into the King of Diamonds instead of creating another inspector or another police officer entirely was...
I get entirely what you mean, John. Sorry for being dense. I very specifically wanted to do that. In The Inheritance, Trave has a degree of personal involvement because he's lost his son in a motorcycle crash, and there is a man who is facing execution in England who reminds him of his son, so it is a sort of a voyage of atonement and a voyage into the past for him as well, but only kind of vicariously. And what I wanted to do in The King of Diamonds was to do something much more specific, to actually make Trave the very center of the issue. So in The King of Diamonds, his estranged wife, whom he still loves, is associated or getting shacked up with a man whom he believes has committed a double murder. But of course, nobody shares that suspicion, and they think that his motivation in suspecting this man is because he wants to get his wife back, and so he is himself suspect, and he has to go through a series of sacrifices while he carries on in pursuit of what he believes to be the truth. And so this inner struggle, I wanted to make the sort of dynamic inside the King of Diamonds. And also it gave me an opportunity to strongly develop a female character, which was took me really back to Final Witness, you know. But in this case, a female character who was drawn between two polar opposites, you know, her ex-husband and the extraordinarily charming, handsome man with the strange past who she's kind of besotted by, who puts the Regency diamond on her finger. So yes, I think is the answer. I wanted to put Trave under extreme personal pressure.
So we're talking here with Simon Tolkien, author of The King of Diamonds, book released. Your website is simontolkien.com. Has a lot of great information people can find out about. And looking here as far as like The King of Diamonds and moving forward and your other books and your past things, and you're starting to see the evolving of technology coming out now with a lot of the e-books. And now, you know, you have Facebook and the Twitters and everything else. How do you think that that's helped you as an author compared to authors, you know, possibly, you know, well, your grandfather didn't have any of that way back when. So how do you think that all this technology has been able to help you, you know, as an author and marketing yourself and moving forward?
I think it's a really uncertain time, to be honest with you, Joe. Mm-hmm. I think that the difficulty is that writing... I mean, some people can dash off a book really fast. For me, writing a book is like a 2-year operation. I plan it really carefully, I research it, and then I execute it. And what I don't quite understand is how these people who, you know, effectively are becoming their own publishers are able to do that and write. I guess they're just kind of like superhuman. But that's the difficulty to me, is that you're not just supposed to be a writer, but effectively you're supposed to be a publisher. I can quite see where they're coming from. I can quite see that, you know, e-book, you know, what is the role of the publisher when, you know, you write and then you can e-book and there's organizations like Amazon to distribute. And it's pretty obvious where the future is going. But perhaps in order to exploit that future, you have to be a technocrat and a marketeer and a self-publicist in addition to being a writer. And I find that kind of difficult, if you know what I mean. So I've read about the man who turned down the $500,000 advance, but
right.
he's got something I ain't.
Well, he's
got the ability to multitask. He can write books. He can market them. He can self-publicize them, and he can do an enormous number of things. But it's just kind of hard on the writer to be able to, you know, do all that, if you know what I mean. But I can see where the future is going. I mean, you know, electronics does mean that, and it provides enormous opportunities. We're clearly at the sort of a tipping point, aren't we?
In
Santa Barbara right now, all the three major... Sorry, I'm talking over you, John. I apologize.
No, go right ahead.
All the three major bookstores have closed.
Right. I was just in Santa Barbara not too long ago, and I noticed that the Borders downtown on State Street was closing, and those things are going away. I think the Barnes & Noble was the only one still open.
The Barnes & Noble went 2 months later, and now the Borders in Goleta, which is the next town along, have closed. So all the bookshops are going, because how can you compete when you can buy at $15 off Amazon what a hardback costs at $25 in a store? You can't compete with that, and it's just reality. Right. And then there's the whole issue of e-book. I mean, I sit there and read books on the iPad at night with a bright light, you know, and it's kind of wonderful, but I don't know.
And I think that you are right. We are definitely at a point now where it's going to tip one way or the other. And I think that you bring a very interesting point up, is how can people just keep writing and writing and writing books? And there's authors out there that you go to the bookstores, and every 3 or 4 months they seem to have another book out. Now, maybe they're collaborating with somebody else, but their name's on the book, where just from listening to your first 5 minutes of talking about King of Diamonds and the Regency Diamond, how much research that had to have taken just to find out the story of the slave cutting himself to hide the diamond to get off and the whole thing. That's what that's what makes your book that much more, has that much more depth than
the
surface of the other people.
I think that's right.
Right.
Although
it's
a difficult balance, isn't it, John? Between, you know, books can become very technical, and then that takes away from the fiction.
Yeah, and there's some authors that have fallen into that trap where you're writing 40 pages on how an airplane works instead of just saying, here's an airplane, and not really getting into that side. But your research is much different, because you're telling the backstory of how the curses and the things in the diamond, and how people can get too enthralled, you know, and too enamored with these jewels and with these items, you know, basically material items.
Yeah.
And that's part of the whole murder mystery that you've wrapped yourself up here with the King of Diamonds.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
But now, coming from, you know, when you first started out here with Final Witness, and you moved yourself forward through The Inheritance and now through King of Diamonds, how do you think that your writing style has kind of changed and evolved, maybe with the times, or how has that kind of evolved you?
Well, I think the phrase "with the times" is kind of critical, because I think you kind of have to accept what your writing style is. I think that, you know, when I was younger, I read an enormous number of 19th century novels, you know, the Brontes and all that, you know, Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre and all that. And I think there's a certain old-fashioned style to the way I write. Now, I could just throw that out of the window and, you know, try and write in a, you know, very quick sentence, quick-fired kind of way, but then that wouldn't be me and it wouldn't work. So I think I've had to accept what I can do and the way in which I write. And with Final Witness, it was ostensibly set as a modern book. By that, I mean end of 20th century book. Mm-hmm. And some people said, well, we feel it's earlier. And then I think after that, not that they felt it detracted from it, but that I needed to, you know, take my setting backwards. And so I went back to 1960. And I think it's curious now that in the book I'm now writing, at the moment, I've actually gone 20 years back. It's still Inspector Trade, but he's a young man. And I've gone back to actually to 1940. And also that I have historical settings to my books. So you have to go where you kind of feel comfortable and where you can have authenticity in relation to your settings. And I think that's been important for me. And I think the other aspect of this is that I am a crime-come-mystery writer, and that with crime-come-mystery, after you get to the end of the 80s and the early 90s, the enormous sudden advances in criminal detection with, you know, DNA and all the all the stuff that you see on CSI, mean that you have to be very, very technical in order to retain belief. And I find that kind of hampering. I find it better to be back, not perhaps in Agatha Christie times, but in, you know, post-Second World War, where basically the issues are things like fingerprints, and you're not into DNA and profiling and all the other things that you came to. I found this a very strong experience in my work as a barrister in England, is that things really changed once you came into DNA and CCTV and stuff like that. So that's, you know, kind of that, you know, experience for me.
And that's an interesting point you bring up, too, because I've mentioned this 100 times before, is detectives today aren't very good instinctive characters like they used to be. If you want to go back with Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot and Miss Jane Marple back then, where they had to use their instincts and their wit and their cutting because there wasn't technology. Nowadays, you have the detective that's superhuman, can shoot through a wall and hit somebody from 100 yards away, and being able to use today's technology to be able to find the crime, and doesn't really have to use his brain. What I think what you do back in the, taking your book back to the 40s, you have to develop a character that has wit and has intelligence more than just has brute strength.
I think this is right. I think that this is the whole argument about special effects, which is, you know, the big argument about the Lord of the Rings movies as well, ironically.
Yeah.
You know, and about whether you become overwhelmed by special effects.
And I think that what that does is, by you having to go back to write like you do in the 60s and the 40s, it challenges you as a writer a lot more than writing something that's now set in today's period.
I'm very interested in character-driven books. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, we're on Suspense Radio. I mean, my idea has always been that the reader should want to turn the page and really want to stay up late at night and want to find out what's next. Read a page turner, but then at the end, hopefully not feel that they've gone down to the local McDonald's and eaten, you know, four Big Macs. You know,
oh my
it's a sort of mixture of quality and page turn. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that the character development drives them back along with the story to the next book.
Yeah.
You know, that's
that's why I've tried to preserve the same character running through the books.
Right. So that was something that you decided, and not your publisher saying, we want to have Inspector
Trade. I thought it was interesting. Oh, yeah, I think publishers like that. I think that you know, Trade number two. But, I mean, to me, it seems very interesting to put them in different situations and at different periods of their life. I mean, I suppose at some point you would say, well, enough is enough. I mean, you know, want to start something new. But at the minute, it's interesting to me.
Now,
preserve the same character.
And Final Witness was a little bit different because it was a little more of a legal thriller drama
where,
you know, you have more murder mystery now. So is the fourth book, and I take it that the third book here for the Inspector Trave, your fourth total book, is going to be along the same lines as the last two. So do you have any plans with kind to come back with another Final Witness or another legal drama here in the future?
Well, it's the issue of courtroom drama. And it's always been the thing that I, you know, I think about a great deal, because my background is as a trial lawyer in England, so I know how it all works. And when I started writing, I think it's always very good to start writing with what you know. But there are issues with courtroom drama, that you are in a particular situation, and once you start showing courtroom, in order to be able to keep the courtroom realistic, it's difficult when you're writing a novel, not to show the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there are risks of becoming static. And as you write more and more books, as I write more and more books, if you continue within courtroom drama, you can feel it very much as a stranglehold. I didn't feel that in The Inheritance. And particularly there, I was exploring the theme of what happens when an innocent man is sentenced to death, you know, focusing on that period in England in the 1960s, so just at the end of the death penalty. But now, I kind of, in the King of Diamonds, the courtroom stuff is there, but it's there, and I was quite pleased with this, it's there as a clue. So the inspector has to go back to the transcript of the previous trial in order to find things in that transcript which are going to give him clues as to what is happening now. And I was quite pleased with that device, because it enabled me to have some courtroom, but not really to be ruled by the need to show all courtroom. And I'm not sure where I'm going to go to with this. I like the idea of the courtroom because I think it's very dramatic, but I don't want to show it all. And so I'm kind of moving more towards police procedural, but I also very much want to keep the historical element going. In my new book, I'm kind of also touching on espionage and a plot to assassinate Winston Churchill.
So you're still setting it over there in more of the English side of the world, since you're talking Winston.
Yeah,
Churchill.
Yeah, I mean there's a European dimension.
Okay.
You know, this one will have the new one has a German dimension, and the last one had a Belgian dimension, because
right.
In order for Trave to find out the truth, as you know, John, in The King of mm-hmm. Diamonds. In The Inheritance, to find out the truth, he had to go to France. And in The King of Diamonds, he has to go back into the past and also go back into Europe and into the Second World War. And that takes him to Belgium and the connections of the man that he suspects with the Holocaust in Belgium, which I did a lot of research on and was very interested by.
And real quick here, just when you talk about
yeah.
research, because a lot of authors don't have the ability, like some authors, to be able to go... you know, to the actual place. So are you able to, you know, go over to Belgium, walk around, see the places, take the pictures, talk to the people, go to the actual documents, or do you have to do a lot of it online? And if, you know, what do you tell authors that can't actually get to the place to be able to research? Should they not write about that?
I have been to Belgium, but in the context of The King of Diamonds, I had to do quite a bit of it online. And in the context of France, in The Inheritance, I spent, you know, during my life, because my father lived in the south of France since I was a teenager, I know France very well. And so the countryside, albeit that I know the south of France pretty well, I was able to transpose that into how I imagine the north of France. I think it really helps to be able to go and to be able to sense these places, albeit that some of the places that I've been writing about no longer exist, I mean, you know, given the legacy of the Second World War. But yeah, I live in California now, which is quite wonderful, but it takes me away from where I write. Oxford is incredibly vivid in my mind, and so mm-hmm. is London. I mean, I grew up in Oxford, and I went to Oxford, to the university there, and so I know all the streets, and that's a wonderful setting for me, and I know the countryside around it. And then I know London as well. So I think that really helps. I think you do need to know your settings. But if you become specific about a specific place, then using your imagination and online research, you can go a long way. But I think to imagine a town completely would be very difficult.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, because we're set here in Southern California. There's no better place in the United States to live, let's face it, with the weather. Even though it has been chilly the last couple of weeks, that's okay. It's still better than what everybody else was experiencing.
Yeah,
so have you thought of maybe
lucky.
Yeah, so have you thought of going ahead and in the future maybe setting a book, like you said, around Santa Barbara, Los Angeles, or around the coast or anywhere in those areas?
Well, what gives me misgiving about that, John, is that I'm a recent arrival. I've only been here a couple of years, and you inevitably, though you really enjoy it, one remains in a certain sense a tourist. You're scratching the surface of the society rather than actually being inside it. And you have to have, when you write a story, you kind of have to know the depths underneath. Even it has to be kind of implicit in your writing, and I wouldn't have that level of depth. That's what kind of scares me off setting a book in America or within American society.
Yeah, but we're pretty simple people, let's face it.
Right, I don't think so. You may.
Yeah.
I don't think so at all.
Well, I'll tell you, see, and it was just that last line when you're talking about depth is why The King of Diamonds is a book that people should pick up, because with Simon Tolkien here, we're talking with him, and it's simontolkien.com to find out more information. And you have the Facebook, so you're doing all the fun stuff to get involved in front of your fans. And that's the reason right there why people need to go out and buy this book, for the simple fact because you do have just such depth with a great story, and your research and everything is just so tight that's the way a book should be written.
Well, thank you, John. I really appreciate that. You know, one of the things that I always feel is that the most important thing is like being able to hear what you write.
Yeah.
It's not reading it aloud, but actually if you can hear the words in your in your head. And when I first started writing, the real problem was is that made me self-conscious, kind of made me want to cringe. You've got to be able to kind of hear the words without worrying about them, but also see how they resonate. I think that's important.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I'm sitting there reading, I try to almost, you know, if I'm into a book a lot, I almost try to imagine the person or the scene developing in front of me, and it's like I'm watching it instead of reading it.
Exactly.
That's how I know that I'm enthralled in a book and how I love it, and that's what King of Diamonds will do to anyone who goes and picks it up. So, hey, what events do you have? You know, do you have anything else coming up in the future, events-wise, that you're doing for King of Diamonds, where maybe people can call you or contact you and get some information?
Well, I got a publicist.
Okay.
And it's all on my website. And I'm always really keen to do anything, you know, which brings the books to a wider audience, because kind of the most thrilling thing about being an author is that you write in your kind of solitary little place, and then all these people that you don't know really enjoy what you write, which is very validating and really exciting. So, you know, I can be contacted through the website, which I try and keep up to date and everywhere and try to keep interesting. And, you know, I'm available to do everything. And I guess, you know, I try and do radio. It's very, very difficult to get anything on television because of the nature of fiction. Because, you know, you're talking about stuff that the people who are watching haven't yet read, if you know what I mean. But radio's fun, and I've always really enjoyed radio. And, you know, the web is huge. And,
oh, the web's big.
And you go endlessly on with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm fairly pleased. It's a slow process, build it up bit by bit, and I'm fairly pleased with where we're going. And then, you know, I'm starting to get translation into German now, and, you know, that's going to start, and French, and, you know, that's exciting as well.
Well, I'll tell you, Simon, we want to thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate the book is The King of Diamonds, available now where all books are sold, if like we just talked about, if you can find a bookstore in your neighborhood. But you can still buy it online, have it sent to you. It's available on ebook and everywhere. Your website is simontolkien.com. So, Simon, again, thank you so much for joining us today. Wish you nothing but success. Love to talk to you in the future when your next book comes out, book 3.
Thank you, John.
Trade.
Thank you, John, and thanks for asking such kind of interesting questions about it.
You're welcome.
I'm really glad you enjoyed the book.
Yes,
all right,
thanks so much. Have a good
one.
Okay,
thank
bye.
You. Bye. Bye.
So, everybody, again, Simon Tolkien, the book here is The King of Diamonds, his third book, second book set with Inspector Trave. It's out now. Website, simontolkien.com. Again, murder mystery set. Don't let the last name fool you. We're not talking science fiction. We're talking depth of history, evolves with, you know, with murder, and you're just talking an all-around book that is, like I said, very tightly, knitly done, and somebody who just writes it, you know, eloquently, brilliantly, I guess you want to say, and there's a lot of Lees at the end of that. So again, The King of Diamonds, you want to check that out. Our next guest is going to be coming up here in 60 seconds while I get something to drink. I will see you. Listen to this. About every episode, because of the book Something to Watch Over Me, Someone to Watch Over Me by Spencer Carstairs, people have been emailing and wanting to know who is this man, this British insider that knows the royal family so well and has written this book, and we decided to bring him back. So everybody, I would like to welcome Spencer Carstairs again to the radio here. We have a lot of news that we want to talk about that Spencer wants to talk about with what's going on with the royal family. You go on Yahoo, you see every day the Kate and Prince William thing. Now they're talking, you know, about her diet and what's going to happen and everything else. So, Spencer, thanks so much for joining us. What the heck is going on over there in Britain? And, you know, what's the stir and what's everybody talking about?
Well, one thing that's happened, John, is that Camilla, Duchess of Cornwall, I was had lunch with Kate Middleton.
Mm.
And, yeah, I can even tell you what they had to eat. This was at an expensive restaurant, Coughlin's, which has just opened in Knightsbridge. And there's nothing wrong with Kate's appetite because she had foie gras and roasted sea bass and finished that off with a pistachio souffle. Camilla was a bit more restrained and had a salad and roast rabbit. Frankly,
now,
I would never eat. Yeah.
Now, real quick, now, from America, why is that very important that Camilla and Kate, you know, have had lunch together? What kind of is the symbolic reason behind that? Because we know Camilla is married to Charles, and Charles is one of the main characters here in the book, Someone to Watch Over Me, when you wrote this story with Camilla kind of behind the scenes. Why is that important so people here in America can understand this, the significance of Camilla and Kate, you know, having lunch?
Well, let me try and give you the context of that. The question is Camilla the queen in waiting? Charles let slip on primetime American television some while ago that, you know, maybe it's possible. He obviously wants it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You can say, let's analyze it under no, maybe yes. No is... she isn't the queen in waiting, and the present queen has decided to preserve the monarchy and is therefore going to outlive Charles. And for the same reason, abdication by her is ruled out completely. Let's say maybe. Well, the constitution is flexible. We go back in time. You remember when the Edward VIII wanted to marry an American lady, Mrs. Wallace
yep.
Simpson. You remember all of that?
Yeah, I do.
He was told by the establishment, very powerful, that his proposition that Mrs. Simpson would become his wife, but not the queen, and be the consort, that, they said, was not possible. Because under English law, a wife automatically takes the status of a husband. When he abdicated, however, he was made His Royal Highness the Duke of Windsor, but she was made Duchess of Windsor, but not His Royal Highness. So if we come on to the significance of the lunch with Camilla and Kate, the status of Camilla's becoming queen is at best uncertain. And it will reside in public opinion. The constitutional position would be that Charles, if he wants to be her to be queen, which he does, we know, mm-hmm. that's the hidden agenda.
Right.
When the time comes, he would go to the Prime Minister and ask. The next one in line, the next Prime Minister in line, is it okay for Camilla to become Queen? Here we run into an immediate complication. Number 10 will have already had discussions with other Commonwealth countries
mm-hmm.
because, as you know, the Queen is not only Queen of Britain, she's Queen of Australia and she's Queen of Canada.
Correct.
There was a Canadian politician, a guy called Tony O'Donoghue, who a little while back, 2002, said that the succession, which determines that the monarch must always be Protestant, was discrimination against non-Anglicans. That came to a court case, and it was decreed that the Act of Settlement of 1701, which determines that only a Protestant can be king or queen of Britain, was part of the Canadian Constitution. The Australians, as you know, had a referendum back in 1999 should they become a republic. And there is a strong sentiment in Australia that they would prefer to be a republic. You know, this is the modern age. Why have they still got the Queen as Queen of Australia? I was in Australia a little while back and met some lady who's on the graphics committee to redesign the flag. They're already redesigning the flag. Take the Union Jack off it. Mm-hmm. But the last time they ran a referendum, five of the six Australian states voted against. Not really, I think, because they want the Queen to hang on and remain the monarch, but they don't want an Australian politician to be president. So, you know, the position in Australia is really open. Come back to Britain. And, you know, when Charles eventually faces up to the Prime Minister at number 10 Downing Street and says, can Camilla be Queen, the issue will be settled as a matter of public opinion. And therefore, Camilla's popularity is of prime concern. And hence, the lunch with Kate, who is a very popular girl, not on the scale of Diana, but she is popular. So Camilla's tactics here are to play happy families and to give the impression, this was a very public lunch, that she and Kate are best friends. And so that's the way.
So it was more of a PR move to show.
It was more of a PR move
on Camilla's side to show that she is extending the olive branch, the hand or whatever, to Kate to bring her into this role that she's not going to, you know, that she's technically not accustomed to because she hasn't been in there yet. And I will say that a lot of the American, you know, tabloid newspapers are all saying that Kate's going to end her the same way as Diana, that she better watch herself, that her fate is going to be the same fate that Diana had. And I don't know if that's the same sentiment over there, if people in Britain are worried about that way. But what your book, Someone to Watch Over Me, does is it shows a behind-the-scenes kind of how all these little things take place and what could happen in these types of settings because of all these hands coming into this, you know, this web of, you know, that extends worldwide.
Yeah, that's right. You see, you've got this situation where I think her parents, Kate's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Middleton, an ordinary couple, had a business of their own. Grandfather lived in a poor part of London. You know, she's not out of the top drawer, as they say. And she's going to be surrounded by a whole lot of protocol, which didn't work to Princess Diana's advantage. Curiously enough, if you go back in time, Camilla had lunch with Diana before that marriage to Charles. So that is the thing. In my book, John, we have a Stuart. The Stuart line disappeared with Bonnie, Prince Charlie. The Stuarts were all Catholic, and there are no heirs except through an illegitimate line. And so no Stuart can succeed to the throne of Britain in real life. But my claimant, the hero Count Paolo Sobieski, is a descendant of a lost son of Bonnie Prince Charlie, who was baptized in Rome in 1774 by, and he was a historic figure, Bonnie Prince Charlie's brother, the Duke of York, who was a cardinal. Mm-hmm. So he's got documents to prove Sobieski's claim. And Prince Charles, this is all tied up as well with religion. You may remember that Henry VIII, before he broke from Rome, was given the title by the then Pope of Fidei Defensor, Defender of the Faith, and that still goes on the British coins, Defender of the Faith, although the monarch, of course, is Protestant and not Catholic. And Charles is slightly vague, to say the least, on the subject of religion. He's technically the head of the Church of England, and that again presents a whole raft of problems because he's married to a divorced lady, and their marriage was in a registry office in Windsor. So if you go back through that, the cutoff of a Catholic candidate is automatic. An heir to the British throne could marry a Buddhist, a Muslim, anybody you like, but they can't marry a Catholic. And okay. where a member of the royal family becomes Catholic, their removal from the succession is automatic. For example, Peter Phillips, the son of Princess Anne, married a Catholic girl, August Kelly, but she had to renounce her religion before she took over. Hell. I think we've run out of time.
Yeah. No, we're good.
Are we're there?
Yeah, oh, yeah, there. Yeah, I'm just listening because...
Okay.
Because well, this is what I want...
Just to tell you that.
Yeah.
Prince Michael of Kent, for example, married a Roman Catholic lady, Baroness Marie Christine von Reibnitz in 1978. He was 15th in line in succession to the throne. He's out.
Okay.
So this bar against the Catholic Church, going back to the Protestant succession, the heirs of
Well, I think we just lost Spencer, and of course he's calling from England. But what I want people to understand is if you didn't have the sense that what he writes about and what he knows about is true, if you would have just heard the last 15 minutes of this and the first interview that we had with him, you'll know that the inner workings of what he writes about here in Someone to Watch Over Me, again, which is a fictional book, but what it does is it shows the behind the scenes of how things can be manipulated, how things maybe are manipulated, because remember, we've had many authors on here talking about spy and espionage. They put things in their book that are true that people don't think are true, because they can't write them as that, and they think, oh, well, that can't go on and that can't happen, where, of course, you know, like with the Brad Thor interview, we've had Mark Greene on, we've had many great authors talking about these things, and that's what Spencer here is doing, is he's bringing him on, and I think we got Spencer back on the air, so let's bring him on so we can finish this thought here. So, Spencer, I know we lost you, but we got you back on. How are you doing?
Yeah, well, all right.
Okay, hey, you know what? You're in England, I'm over here. Things sometimes happen. You know, they just happen that way. Like I was telling everybody when you kind of dropped off was this, is that what I want you to relay to people is when they read the book, Someone to Watch Over Me, and like I just said, if they didn't think now, you know, how the insider system works just from listening to you here for the last 15 minutes, I don't know what's going to convince them. But what's the single most thing that you think that you want them to get out of the book, and why maybe Britain doesn't want to publish something like that because it is hot? What can you tell them? This is what I want you to get out of it when you read it.
Well, let's go back to this question of religion, which is integral to the whole Constitution and Prince Charles's position. He has said that he would rather be defender of faith
rather than the faith, the title that the Pope gave to Henry VIII. So that could embrace Islam. You know, that's Islam is a faith. So Sobieski's appeal is increased in the book by a publicity campaign in which two contrasting women fight for his hand in marriage because the expatriate media mogul who's backing him thinks he'd be more have more political sex appeal if he was married. There's one's a German countess, the other's an American actress. And all of this rolls up into, an issue where public opinion is gathering behind Sobieski and the pretender. So Charles runs an advertising campaign prepared by a New York City advertising agency for reasons of security, but paid for by the Saudi royal family, who like this idea of defender of faith. What do I want people to get out of it? Well, look, it's a very good story. Clouds of suspicion still hang around over the death of Princess Diana. I think that should history now. But there is an enormous amount of intrigue around the royal family, which very much continues. I mean, my view is that Camilla, who after all was responsible for breaking up Diana's marriage. You remember that Diana famously said, the trouble with my marriage is there are three people in it.
Right.
I mean, why should this woman become Queen of England? That doesn't seem to me to be exactly right. So that's the, I suppose, the political point in a story, but which is really a thriller set around the royal family and Charles being threatened. And in real life, he is threatened, but not by a Stuart pretender, Sobieski, but by his own son, William, and Kate, who are much more popular than he and Camilla are. In fact, public opinion polls suggest that a majority of people in Britain would much prefer that William and Kate take over, and it jumps a generation after the death of the Queen.
So now you're saying that the third person involved was people were thinking it was Queen Elizabeth, but in tune was actually Camilla, was when Diana said there were three people with my marriage.
Yeah, she meant Camilla, of course.
And a lot of people believe that it was the Queen Elizabeth. Especially over here in the States.
I see what you mean.
Yeah.
I don't think she was meaning that. I mean, they were probably not as friendly as they might have been. And she was the daughter of an earl, the same as my Christian name, Earl Spencer. So she was kind of used to the aristocratic way of things. But Kate Middleton isn't. No, I think she meant that Camilla was still around.
Ah, see, and that's another big bombshell that you kind of laid, because that's the first time I think I've ever heard that. Again, over here in America, you know, we love to hear and we talk about the family and people are talking, but what they talk about is more either the glamorous side of, you know, people are going to watch William and Kate's marriage like they watched Charles and Diana's wedding, and they're going to watch all that. And because no one really watched Charles and Camilla's wedding. I mean, that was not a big media event over here in the States. But Kate and William's marriage is going to be a huge media event. And then,
of course,
the death of Diana was a worldwide media event. And so I think that America likes the very, very high, like in the marriage of Princess and Diana, but then, or Charles and Diana, but then the very, very low as of the death of Diana. So I think where America gets lost is the in-between part. And that's the void that you fill also with talking with us here, with the book Someone to Watch Over Me, you're taking that void and you're filling that middle part that America just doesn't quite get.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's a good read.
It is very good, and it's very fast. So I want to remind everybody that the book here is Someone to Watch Over Me, available in ebook form wherever you can find it. You know, we're going to be doing a lot more publicity. I'm going to be going on different radio shows and talking about this, too, because we feel very strongly that this is, you know, when anybody says a book is too hot to publish in Britain, it's definitely something that we want to have here in the United States. And we thank Spencer again. And I know that Spencer's going to join us again, probably coming up soon, because as soon as more news comes out, and, you know, with the wedding and everything that's happening with William and Kate, we're definitely going to get Spencer back on, because where else can you find out about what somebody's eating for lunch than right here on Suspense Radio, Morton, and, of course, with Spencer Carstairs. So, Spencer, I want to thank you so much for coming on again, and we will be talking very shortly.
Good talking to you, John. Thank you very much.
You have a good day.
Okay. Bye for now.
Right,
bye for now.
So again, everybody, Spencer Carstairs, the book is Someone to Watch Over Me, the story of the royal family with murder, intrigue, deceit, the mystery surrounding Princess Diana. It's definitely something you want to check out on the ebooks and Amazon, Kindle, Barnes Noble, wherever you find ebooks, download them to your readers. Our first guest here was Simon Tolkien, simontolkien.com, with his latest book, talking about The King of Diamonds, that's out now, available. Where if you can find a bookstore, ebook, and where books are sold. His site is simontolkien.com. Second book of his Inspector Trace series. I don't know if it's really a series, but now it's becoming one since he, you know, told us that his next book is going to also have Inspector Trace. That's definitely a book that you want to check out, The King of Diamonds by Simon Tolkien. Well, I'll tell you, I want to thank everybody for listening to us. It's been a great show. You can listen to all the back shows here on Blog Talk Radio, Suspense Radio, by just, you know, scanning through and finding your authors. Our April edition is coming up. We're going to have an article by David Morrell on how the publishing industry has changed and how he sees it maybe going into the future. And if anybody knows David Morrell, of course, the creator of Rambo, along with the great book, The Brotherhood of the Rose, has been one of the pioneers out in front to say, you know, this is what's going on, and had his book, The Naked Edge, published exclusively in ebook, which was an unprecedented event for someone of his stature to be able to say, I'm not doing the print, I'm doing the exclusive ebook here on Amazon, and the book, The Naked Edge. And we have David on there to talk about it. You can listen to the interview that we had with him a couple months back speaking about that. So, again, that's great. We want to, we will see everybody here coming up on April the 2nd, we're going to have another interview. We're going to have Les Wheel coming up here in the next couple weeks. Barry Eisler is going to be on. Heather Graham's going to be on. We're going to be with Catherine Coulter at the RT Book Convention, and that is April the 6th through the 10th. If you're out there, check us out. Come up to us. Say hi. We'd love to see, see fans and see everybody. It's another great way to be able to meet your authors. So I want to thank everybody for, the Simon and Spencer for coming on with us today. And we will see you all, coming up here again next weekend. And it's been great fun. This is John Simon, Suspense Radio. See ya. We got to go.